matter for today, SKS and Associates versus Thomas Dart.
Good morning, members of the panel. My name is Zane Smith. I am the attorney for the plaintiff and the petitioner in this appeal.
Let me, Mr. Smith, ask you how service was obtained with regard to the defendants.
We served the clerk of the court.
You serve who?
The clerk of the court.
And?
Maybe I'm not understanding the panel's question.
No, down in the when you originally brought the suit.
In the district case?
Yes.
Yes, we served the clerk of the court of Cook County.
Okay. For service on who?
The chief judge, Judge Wright.
What about the sheriff?
We served the sheriff himself.
That's not part of the record here. So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, that's how we did service on the...
So they had actual service.
They did. Members of the panel, the issue in this case is really four issues. The first issue to be determined is whether or not Judge Wright, when he issued general order providing for a holiday break... for the issuance of judgments and possession of properties that were the subject of repossessions by my client, whether or not that general order and the issuance by Judge Wright allowed Judge Wright judicial immunity.
So I have a real fundamental question here, which is why a federal court has any business looking at particular procedural rules adopted by the state court for case processing, because it seems to me if it was your view that Judge Wright exceeded his authority under whatever body of law you want, from the federal constitution on down to Cook County ordinances, all you had to do was pursue one of your cases where you thought that execution of the eviction order ought to take place faster. And if, based on Judge Wright's order, your effort was unsuccessful, the state courts are open for business. It seems to me that you're asking us to review either a legislative enactment by the courts, namely the enactment of procedural rules, or possibly even a judicial act of the courts, in which case I would start worrying about things like Rooker-Feldman and abstention doctrines and the like. And finally, I'm having a little bit of trouble figuring out how a federal court is in a position to say, well, you shouldn't give people a 2.5-week window for executing eviction orders, but maybe a month is enough. I mean, this is such a micro level of administration that it seems to me principles of comedy suggest federal courts shouldn't be involved.
Well, of course, our position is exactly the opposite, Your Honor, which is this is a case that would be ripe for consideration at the federal level. The two constitutional questions that are before you are the First Amendment violation of the establishment of a religion. The general order issued by Judge Wright is, although it's not named that, is basically a holiday, a Christmas holiday break for the enforcement of orders of possession.
Why is it a Christmas holiday break? I happened to look this up, and in 2008, Hanukkah began at sundown on the 21st of December and went on for 8 days. The Islamic New Year was the 29th of December. Kwanzaa was the 26th of December. Christmas, of course, is the 25th of December. Lots of schools have a break during that particular two-week period. And obviously, New Year's Day was the 1st of January, 2009. So the judge, following practice, issued this break.
And you're right, in that particular year, for example, Hanukkah fell in that particular window.
And it always does.
Right. How would your theory affect weekends? Saturdays and Sundays are Sabbaths in different traditions, and courts are usually closed for this kind of thing.
My theory would be that the court does have the ability to set up and manage its own policies and procedures for the enforcement of state court. We're not arguing that, and that's not a question. The issue is whether or not the rules that are promulgated by the court, in this particular case, Judge Wright's general order, The problem with it is that it only affects a certain class of litigants, that is landlords. This is not a case where there's a weekend or Lincoln's birthday where the entire court system is closed to all litigants.
I don't understand why you couldn't have just challenged this in one of those cases.
Because there is no ability to bring Judge Wright to task for this issue.
Let's follow this up. To have standing to raise this claim, you've got to have some cases pending, specific cases pending in the circuit court, right?
Correct. Which we did in the underlying court. We named the cases.
Okay. And in that instance, why can't you simply go to one of the judges who's presiding over those cases and say, we think this is invalid for federal constitutional reasons, and we think there's an obligation to order the sheriff to go ahead, notwithstanding Judge Wright's order?
The issue is,
why didn't you do that?
Because the perfect defense for Sheriff Dart is, I'm following the judge's order.
Right.
I'm following the general order.
But Judge Hamilton would say, why didn't you go to the judge who's presiding over the eviction case, and you say, Judge Wright's order is ultra vires. Judge Wright had no authority to enter that order. Just like you might say, you know, Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 35 is unconstitutional or whatever. There's nothing that says you can't challenge court orders.
Well, but the court order that would be challenged was, in fact, issued by the state court, was proper. The state court judge who issued the order of possession didn't do anything wrong. He ordered that the sheriff go out and evict. So now the sheriff doesn't evict. The sheriff says,
you just get an order that says evict them tomorrow.
Notwithstanding Judge Wright's order.
Because it would be unenforceable. The sheriff would simply say, pursuant to Judge Wright's order, I can't evict. I'm following the judge's orders. What the panel is suggesting.
You're assuming that the state courts are incapable of resolving a conflict between the eviction order and Judge Wright's order, and I can't believe that they are.
The fact of the matter is, Judge Wright's order is an order where there was no controversy, no litigant, and no ability to appeal.
So what? I mean, so were the standing orders, as Judge Shader referred to, in the district courts here. You know, I want you to give us two copies of your motions, and I want you to, you know, call the clerk's office to notice them up, or whatever the judge is saying in these orders. People have orders. These are kind of you run into a different kind of immunity problem, by the way, because if they really are legislative, it could be that Judge Wright, if he's got legislative authority, has legislative immunity for this. But be that as it may, the federal constitutional issue is perfectly capable, and federal constitutional issues come up in enforcement proceedings all the time. You may be familiar with lines of cases that look at garnishment, lines of cases that look at evictions, lines of cases that look at all sorts of enforcement level challenges to the propriety of procedures. That's what you seem to have. And if you're complaining about a taking, the Illinois Claims Court is open for you.
But the taking in this particular situation, because of the way Judge Wright's general order is written, rises to a level of a constitutional question that should and must be determined by the federal court.
Are any
this
cases
exact
still
issue
pending?
Pardon me?
Do we still have a live controversy here?
Of the cases that were issued that were addressed in the underlying cause, I believe two of them are still pending. That's my understanding.
No effort to execute on two of the eviction orders?
There's been many efforts to execute. The problem is,
so in other words, sheriff has by now done everything you ever asked.
No. What happens is, because there used to be a 90-day, now there's a 120 rule, if the sheriff doesn't evict within the 90 days, now 120 days, my clients then have to go back into court, petition the court for another extension, give that to the deputy sheriff. The sheriff then makes a determination in their own discretion as to whether or not they're going to enforce that order. That's the problem with the order, is that the sheriff has absolute discretion to or not to evict these people, depending on what he believes is to be dangerous or not dangerous, or a particular temperature that gives rise to some particular danger. The problem
on
with
July
this
the 15th, he can say, well, I think it's 15 degrees Fahrenheit or colder.
No, he can say, I think it's too hot, or it's too wet, or it's too buggy, or it's too dark. The problem with the order is that the language within the order is it's a temperature or when the sheriff's department determines that it's unsafe to evict these people. There is no ascertainable way to determine whether or not the deputy is or is not carrying out the order of the court orders that my client paid money to get, there is no way to ascertain whether or not it's reasonable for the sheriff to or not to evict that particular person. The issue is, in this particular case, is one that was considered by the Sixth District Court. Is it exactly the same fact circumstances under Morrison? And that court found that, in fact, there were constitutional issues in that case. And the issue becomes a federal constitutional question when my litigants really have nowhere to go but the federal court. The panel has suggested, well, why don't you go back to the state judge who issued the eviction notice? When you do that, the state judge says, I've issued the order to the deputy to the sheriff. There's nothing more I can do.
Well, yes, do you reject all possibilities of appeals or mandamuses or other writs? You think the state courts just don't monitor them?
I don't reject that at all, Your Honor. In this particular case, the writ of mandamus is not available. A writ of mandamus is only available for non-discretionary acts.
And it becomes non-discretionary when you move beyond the scope of the discretion that the Constitution and laws give you.
Looking at Judge Wright's order, the way it's written, it is a non-discretionary, it is a discretionary act. The way it is
set. Why doesn't that conflict with the underlying statute that permits evictions for people who aren't paying their rent or whatever? Why doesn't Judge Wright's order, as you are reading it, conflict with the underlying state statute that permits evictions? The underlying state statute doesn't give people an eternal right to live in somebody else's property.
The underlying statute doesn't have a time limit either. It doesn't say, for example, the proper way to do this would be to say, here's an order of eviction, it stayed for 14 days, after 14 days the eviction can proceed. We don't have that case. My client has a situation where the tenants are gaming the system. They know that if they stop paying rent in October, that it'll take at least 30 days to get before a judge, that once it's called, no evictions will be taking place, they can live rent-free from October through April. That has been part of the process for years. That's why my client and the class of similarly situated clients have gotten together and said, look, the only way we're going to get a resolution to this is take it to the federal level. The same as the city of Chicago under Shackman took it to federal level, the same as this court micromanages the public housing, the same as this court micromanages the issues that evolve around other issues that involved the prison, for example, overcrowded prisons. The panel has suggested, Judge, that why should the federal court step in and micromanage the court system? Why should they get involved in the minutia of how to run the day-to-day operations of the court? And I think the answer is because it's a clear constitutional issue that can only be resolved at the federal level. Because of the nature of the general order, there is no relief available to my clients.
Thank you, Mr. Smith.
Thank you.
Taken under advisement, the court.